You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along, another piece of America's lost.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, Country Music Edition. My name is Coy O'Neill. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. And it has been a while since I've hosted an episode of anything, I'm probably going to butcher the introductions, but as always on these country music episodes, we have joining us today Danny Anderson of the Sectarian Review podcast, also on the Christian Humanist Radio Network, and of you're going to have to help me with this, Danny, even though you just told me.
Mount Aloysius
College.
The Count of the Mounts, as Todd called them.
Yeah, okay, there we go. In Crescent, Pennsylvania, is that right?
Yeah.
Awesome,
right.
I got that one. I was going to say St. Crescent, but that didn't sound right, so there we go. Also joining us is Michael Farmer and Man About Town in Atlanta. Is that where you're at now, Michael?
I am, yeah. I live in Woodstock right now, but maybe by the time this airs, we'll have moved.
That's so entirely possible. Cool. We take our time getting these posted. Co-host of the Christian Humanist radio network and show, right? Christian Humanist. Man, I am butchering this. Podcast, thank you.
There you go.
Yeah. It really has been like 3 months since I've hosted an episode. Either Ed's been doing it or we've just been running things that we have logged. So we are recording this right after what our George Jones, Johnny Cash, and Elvis episode dropped. So that's kind of where we're at.
We recorded like 8 months ago, right?
Oh yeah. That was sort of an odd one in that it wasn't timeline specific. Unlike today, when we're talking about the 1980s, the 1980s is. It feels to me, and if you guys want to push back on this and tell me I'm wrong, that's fine, but it feels to me like a transitional time in country music. This is kind of genuinely second generation country. We're 30 years from the death of Hank Williams, right? And as much as saying a generation even means anything, it tends to be about 30 years kind of rolling between them. We have a new generation of singers with new influences on them. People who, instead of listening to jazz and original rock and roll music from the 50s. We have people who were raised on the Eagles and the Allman Brothers and Bon Jovi and Led Zeppelin and so on. We also have a movement away from, in some senses, away from rural America and towards urban and urbane life, and then a pushback to that movement with an intentional moving back towards rural America, which I think Danny is going to talk to us a little bit about, and then a sense of searching for something different, as second generations tend to do, right? The sense that what our parents had, what the previous generation had, is maybe okay in its place. But we want our own voice, and we're just not entirely sure what that is. Which isn't to say that the music singers at the time in the 1980s would have said all of that. That's all in retrospective at the time. I would imagine they would have said, we're just doing exactly what country music has always done, and maybe doing it better, maybe doing it worse.
What they probably would have said is, pass me some of that cocaine. I'm not sure they thought it out that well. Can we agree that the early 80s in particular are a real dark age for country music, for mainstream country music?
Well, I mean, that is when George Strait starts, but he's kind of a unique exception.
Yeah.
I think in general, it is very, it's like the worst, it's like the end of country politan, right? And it's
right.
Like the worst version of pop country crossover crap.
And the term that gets used sometimes is urban cowboy, which is as ugly a term for a genre of music as you're ever going to hear, I think.
It was a John Travolta movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, Roseanne Cash, who I know we're going to talk about in a little while, her first few albums get filed under that urban cowboy name. And there's a real slickness to it that goes even beyond Countrypolitan and the Nashville sound.
Yeah.
I really think it's a dark, dark era for country music. The first half of the 80s, once you get past the middle of the 80s and you get the neo-traditionalist revival that we'll talk about in a few minutes, things get much better. But, man, it must have been rough to be a country music fan in the early 80s.
And I think I agree, but... So I agree. If you ask me, do I like 80s country music, my answer is no. But then if you ask me, do I like any single singer who came into their own in the 80s, you know, George Strait or Randy Travis or Dwight Yoakam or any of the people we're going to talk about today, my answer is almost always going to be yes. So
late 80s. Those are all people who hit their stride in the late 80s.
Well, even people in the earlier 80s, Kathy Mattea or... Oh, I even like Conway Twitty, and I know you guys are going to yell at me for that later. I'm sympathetic to them, even though you're right. The era sits poorly with me. We should get into some of these. I'm going to talk just briefly about vocal groups. Maybe one of the reasons the 80s is such a dark time, in the early 80s anyway, is because in some ways this is the decade of group acts. Especially quartets and duos. Up until then, quartets had largely served as backups to solo acts. So the Statler Brothers, if you knew them at all, you knew them from their work with Johnny Cash. Duos were usually two single artists working together on specific projects. Of course, George Jones and Tammy Wynette, we talked about that. And Conway Twitty and what's her name? Loretta Lynn, right?
Loretta Lynn.
Yeah,
what's her name? You remember What's, Conway Twitty, but you don't remember...
Like, well, no, I couldn't remember who specifically... I couldn't remember who he had worked with, and I almost said someone else, but it was Loretta Lynn.
Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton.
Right. So
although, you know what? I'll go to bat for Kenny. Like, that guy has the voice of an angel.
Yeah, that's fair. He has some terrible, terrible songs, but it's not because of his singing ability.
Are you thinking Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town or Coward of the County?
Well, those are both. I'm thinking kind of all of his songs. He would be one of the people I don't particularly care for.
Islands in the Stream, the duet with him and Dolly Parton. Victoria and I like to say that song has more chest hair than any pop song in the 20th century.
Aside from those kinds of groups, the 80s is when the groups come into their own. That's all they are. So the Oak Ridge Boys, for example, had started out as a gospel group in the 60s, cross into the country in the 70s, and then really hit it big in the 1980s with their hit Elvira. They set the goal for themselves of being the first group to win CMA's Entertainer of the Year award, then make the mistake of kind of publicly saying that. Of course, the Country Music Association has to punish them. The group who gets it, the first group who gets it, is Alabama, who get it the next year, actually in 1982, and then win it the next 2 years after that. So they win 3 years in a row. Alabama is an interesting group. They actually start out playing clubs in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and manage to hit a balance of kind of pure country music. I mean, no one can listen to them and say that they are not country music, but it's a sort of country music that is going to appeal very broadly. If you don't like country, Alabama is still very likable.
They're a pop rock band in some ways.
Oh, yeah.
And very southern rock influenced, I think, as well. I mean, they're not like Lynyrd Skynyrd, but you could tell they liked Lynyrd Skynyrd, sort of, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, my father's family is from northern Alabama, near Huntsville, and when we would visit them from Atlanta, we would go through this town called Mentone, Alabama, which is where they're from. And twice a year, for the first 18 years of my life, my father pointed out, this is the bar where Alabama got their start. And I thought, gosh, who cares?
They've got a great discography, though. I mean, I have to say, a singles band, a lot of forgettable music, but then a lot of really tremendous songs, I think. I think they're one of the bands in the early 80s that did kind of raise the bar for what country music largely was doing in that kind of dark era.
Sure.
What song would you recommend our listeners listen to, Danny?
Oh gosh, what's the one where they're playing in a bar?
Fiddle in Texas.
You gotta have a fiddle in the band.
Yeah, that is a good song.
Really,
yeah.
I'd go to Song of the South, but
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's later. That's later '80s, right?
It is.
Yeah, No, but yeah.
Is that the name
Roll
of the
on.
Song?
Roll on.
Driver, yeah. That's a corny song, but I love it. The big hit I remember from my childhood is I'm in a Hurry and Don't Know Why.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that was a fun one.
I'm in a hurry to get things done. Oh, I rush until life's no fun. All I really gotta do is live and die, but I'm in a hurry and don't know why. Don't know why. I have to drive so fast, my car has nothing to prove. It's not you, but it'll do 0 to 60 in 5.2.
Which there was the country station in Atlanta in the early 90s had a musician, a DJ called Moby, because he was a big fat guy, Moby in the Morning. And one of the ads for this station featured that song and Moby waiting in a line to go to the bathroom in visible distress. So that kind of ruined that song for me. I can't think of it as anything but like, oh, I have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, but also like as a vocal group, really great harmonies. Like they're cousins, aren't they? Aren't there like two of them are brothers and they're cousins with the other one, or something like that? I think
I'm tempted to say something unflattering about being from the South, but I won't.
But no, I mean, I think they really are really a talented band that had a number of really really great songs, I'm not surprised that they won Entertainer of the Year, particularly in that era, because I mean their music I think was markedly better than most of what was on the radio.
Certainly better than the Oak Ridge Boys.
Yeah,
very that's corny. Fair. That's
although fair. Elvira is a Rodney Crowell song, I have to say.
You have to stick up for it.
Well, I mean the song is better than their they do with it. I just love Rodney Crowell. I'm always going to throw his name out.
Them announcing that they're going to be the first group to win the Entertainer of the Year reminds me of that guy from Miami Vice wearing that EGOT necklace, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony necklace.
Nice. Briefly, other groups, the Bellamy Brothers come into their own kind of in this time. If you've not encountered them, I would say you should probably listen to a couple of Bellamy Brothers songs, and then you don't need to do any more than that. Old Hippie is such a great song.
Their greatest hits, another, like a lot of really great songs from a bunch of laid back, I think, clearly doing marijuana hippies.
You know. Finally, marijuana made its way into country music.
Yeah. The book I was reading that talked about them a little bit made the point that if you want to like the South but are worried that people will think you're racist, the Bellamy Brothers is your group, because they are deeply, deeply nostalgic, without going sort of into the overly nationalistic direction or without overly romanticizing the South. I don't know if I agree with that or not, largely because I haven't listened to enough of their music, but sure.
They're the guys who peaked in high school. Basically, and
they're still out there and recording stuff,
actually saw them when I was a kid. My family and I went to Nashville, and this is sort of like old Nashville still, like in the 80s, I guess. It was still before everything changed physically in the city itself, so we went to one of these country music television shows, Crook and Chase. Do you remember the Crook
yeah,
and Chase?
Yeah, the Country Countdown, right?
Yeah, I don't know that one.
And Lorianne Crook and Charlie Chase. Like, geez, I can't believe I remember their names. But we went to see a live taping of their show, and the Bellamy Brothers were the musical guests. And we were standing in the parking lot when they drove in, and it's just like two dudes driving in like some Honda Civic. It was just like so low-key that they didn't even have a nice car, and they're just like waving at everybody. And yeah, it was very, it's a different era for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Also part of this era, the Judds, right? We've talked about them before. Combine a kind of folksy atmosphere with nostalgic music, and a showman sense of what's good in the market. Largely Naomi Judd, I think, with that kind of market animal cunning that hit the right notes at the right time.
It might be worth pointing out that Naomi Judd is kind of a terrible person.
Yes.
If our listeners have not listened to the episode of Cocaine and Rhinestones about the Judds, they must do so. It's amazing. I was kind of vaguely aware of the Judds. My sister took vocal lessons and had to sing Love Can Build a Bridge 300 times, so I've heard that song more times than I would care to. But it's really remarkable how terrible Naomi Judd was to her daughters. And she was bad to Winona. She was extra bad to Ashley, who basically gets abandoned when Naomi and Winona go on tour. So,
right.
Bummer.
Yeah, and they were my favorite group when I started listening to country music, which I didn't know all of that, and I don't know
really?
That. Well, I don't know that a 8-year-old should have known all that anyway. But yeah, they were, or I guess I would have been probably 5 or 6 because they ended in 1989, I think, was when they did their farewell tour. Yeah, the first concert I ever went to was the Judds farewell tour.
Hmm.
Wow, my first concert I think was Vince Gill. So,
yeah, we'll get to him in a couple of episodes. But man, that guy has a voice too.
Yeah, no, he's a real talent.
Well, that's enough about groups. Danny, talk to us about neo-traditionalism.
Well, I might be defining that a little differently than some people, but for me, it kind of is. I kind of equate it to almost like a DIY, almost punk attitude, right? In which, if you think about punk music, it's very strip. It's a reaction to progressive rock and disco and all that kind of stuff, and it strips rock and roll down to 3 basic chords and emotion, right? Which right. Stylistically fits very nicely with early rock and roll in the 50s, right? And I think in a lot of ways, the neo-traditional music was doing the same thing. It's kind of trying to separate itself from just the kind of what we were talking about, the dreck of the early 80s, which this is where like crossover appeal becomes, it's almost indistinguishable from crappy pop music, right? And so like whatever's being the crappy music on the country radio, you can't even tell the difference between it and the crappy music on the other stations. And so I think
kind of like country music in 2020.
Yes, absolutely. We've returned to the back to the future, as it were. I think that the neo-traditional, there was like a real ethos kind of, and I think you see a lot more I kind of dedication to kind of musicianship and craft and songwriting and what is meant to be authenticity. And we could talk about the nature of authenticity with country music, I guess. But I want to make an argument about Roseanne Cash, because I think she's like a really important figure to set up. I wouldn't put her in the neo-traditional grouping. But I think when 7 Year 8 comes out in, like, what is that, 81 or something like that, that song is tremendous. And it does have you can tell how it's one of these crossover appeal songs, right, like that era. But there's also a real artistry to it. It's almost like an alternative country music song. It's almost like alt country before there was such a thing. That album is actually really tremendous too, and if you look at some of the players on that album, Tony Brown, plays keys, and he ends up producing Dwight Yoakam. Rodney Crowell, who was her husband at the time, is on that. Vince Gill, Emmylou Harris, Albert Lee playing guitar, Ricky Skaggs. I mean, there's like heavyweight musicians on that album, right? And so I kind of think of that as almost like a transition where country music like was revaluing the art a little bit. And then from there, I think you have like a context for what people were trying to do with their acts, I guess. Michael, do you have anything else to say about Roseanne Cash before I move on?
I don't know her early material super well. I mean, I know the song 7 Year Ache, but mostly what I know from her is the stuff she's done in the last 15 years, which is really more in the kind of Americana vein.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's not a surprise. I think a lot of the neo-traditional people are kind of a precursor to Americana, right? Because very quickly, country becomes poppy again, and they don't have a stomach for the traditional stuff anymore. And now, but with the advent of the Americana, whatever, marketing label, there's a place for people like that. And people like Roseanne Cash certainly flourish, I think, in that.
But Danny, I mean, neo-traditionalist country is pop country, right? I mean, it's much, much glossier than the stuff that they're kind of imitating from the 50s and 60s. So, I mean, it's not as glossy as Urban Cowboy. It's not as glossy as Countrypolitan. But nobody's really going to mistake neo-traditionalist country for traditional country, I don't think. And in fact, I remember the argument in the 90s was about how authentic that neo-traditionalist country really was. It seems like a funny argument to have now, because all of those people sound more like country music than anything currently on the country station. But
yeah, for sure. And I agree with that. The production value particularly, I think that you see a lot of like production in there. But I guess there's more of an identifiably country twang to it, if you just kind of make a generalization. But that is a thing about this movement. I don't think it's a monolith. I think within that sector of country, of pop country radio, I think that there is like a lot of variation. Dwight Yoakam is completely different than Randy Travis, right? And I know that you put Steve Earle Coyle in the next section, but I would lump Steve Earle into this. He's completely different than Dwight Yoakam, right? And so there's all sorts of variation within this. But so I'll just kind of go through a list of who I think are prominent people, and you guys can whatever add to it or whatnot. But so I think that for me, one of my favorite musicians ever is Dwight Yoakam, and I think he's definitely, I think he's traditional in a kind of a postmodern sense, right? I mean, he's a completely constructed self.
Right. I think you would almost put him in the group I'm going to talk about.
I suppose, but when you see his band, though. I mean, old guy in overalls playing the fiddle, right? I mean, it's very like, it's like a hyper real version of rockabilly, is how I would put it, right?
Hyper real is a really good word for it.
Yeah, and so it's like, but when you listen to that first album, particularly that Guitars Cadillac. That is a really stripped down hillbilly sound. I mean, he's born in Kentucky, kind of raised in Columbus, Ohio, and then ends up making it in Bakersfield, California, right? And so he's got all of these kind of like different influences that make his music really distinctive. But he's like trying to kind of imagine what Buck Owens would sound like today, I think, is what he would. And he ends up recording with Buck Owens and becoming really close friends with him, actually. But I think when you think of it's not like a, it doesn't sound like that era, but it's a recreation of that era. And he would play in punk clubs in LA, right? I mean, so he had his own kind of weird mystique. He's a creature completely from outside of Nashville, and I think that that's why he was able to be so kind of weird. And just
before you move on from Yoakam, am I right to think of him as a kind of country music Tom Petty? Number one, they kind of look alike, but isn't Tom Petty kind of doing the same thing in the late 70s with 50s like, and 60s rock music
with like the Byrds and stuff,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, there's a story that when Roger McGuinn from the Byrds hears American Girl on the radio for the first time, he thinks, when did I record that? Like, he legitimately thinks he's listening to him because Petty's doing this kind of super good impression of him. And Petty, too, has so much in common with punk as opposed to the music that was actually going on at the time.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say about both of them is both of them make this music that sounds really, really easy to do, but try to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And the session people he would get to be his backup man, incredible musicians, and Tony Brown like doing a great job producing these records, right? It used to be on YouTube, this video of him doing Little Sister, I think, his cover of the Elvis song, on the Carson show. And that is the coolest group of people I've ever seen in my life. They are just so, like, utter hipster, right? But it's utter hillbilly at the same time. And so that's kind of what his kind of angle, I think, in it was. Coral, you want to say something there?
Yeah, I love Dwight Yoakam. I agree with you, but my gut reaction to him is always, this is great music, but I think the content of almost all of his music is deeply urban. Am I wrong about that?
It's all about Hollywood, right?
It's Hollywood, it's the streets of Bakersfield, it's the lonely streets I call home, it's all set in the city. So it's so interesting that he's such a pillar in country music.
But those are about people who left the country for the city, right?
Sure. I mean,
and so it's like...
But even then, he usually doesn't say that. Like, that's always in the background.
I don't know. Reading, writing Route 23.
A story about a naive fool who came to Babylon and found out that the pie didn't taste so sweet.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But even, I mean, the song Reading, Writing Route 23 is about the migration from, like, the coal mine eras into the north, right?
Sang Dixie, yeah.
Yeah, exactly mirrors that. So I think, I mean, he's distinctly hillbilly, but out of that context, right? And so I think that's what gives him this, he's a very uncanny figure, if you want to use horror terms, right? Because he's neither here nor there, which makes him, and honestly, his whole career is like an A+. I mean, every one of his albums are just excellent, right? He's never released a bad album, and he has a really great album of just acoustic, him and an acoustic guitar is magic. It's called...
The only problem with that album is it's called Dwight Yoakam Acoustic.net.
I know. So I think it's meant to be like, this is a bootleg, right? And I think that's how he, and it's an amazing album, right? And really showcases his talent, so.
I will say it's an A+ career, except when he tried to act.
Well, I think he's good in Sling Blade.
I like that he's able to, I mean, he doesn't, I mean, he got this, like, sexy man persona on stage, right?
It's amazing, because he's got to be one of the top 10 ugliest people in country music history.
As
really makes Tom Petty look good.
That's why he wears his hat so low, right? But still, the coolest person in the history of country music,
sure.
I would say.
Yeah, he's cool in that postmodern way, like you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Another really, I think, important figure, even I think predating Dwight Yoakam, is George Strait, who I, like, his early albums, I mean, are real throwbacks to kind of Texas traditional, like, country music, right? I don't know that there's a better country song than Amarillo by Morning. Like, I think it's like a fantastic song, beautifully sung and beautifully written.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I got is just what I've got on. When that sun is high in that Texas sky, I'll be bucking at the county fair. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo, I'll be there.
And so, like, so much of his early work is like that, and just kind of, it's stark for how different it sounds from the pop country stuff. There's, like, no way he's anything but this kind of traditionalist country singer with a white hat, right? I kind of, like, lose patience with his career very early on, because I feel like, he gets applause for the length of his relevance on the charts, but I really think that's because he's just this formless thing with no essential self, right? And so he can always make a pop song in every era that's it's a hit, because there is no real George Strait there, I think. And so I kind of have mixed feelings about it. I really, like, admire and respect most of the early first half of the 80s stuff. Then you get to All My Exes Live in Texas. It's funny and it's cute but it's really shticky and
oh, but he sings the hell out of that song.
Absolutely, I'm not arguing with the talent. I just think that the artistic vision is of the group that I'm talking about. He's like the least ambitious artist.
So you're gonna check no on George Strait.
I like him. Oh, I missed the. Oh Lord, yeah, exactly. I will do that.
What's interesting to me about him is how little of himself he reveals in the songs or in his public persona or anything.
Yeah.
To listen to Johnny Cash is to know Johnny Cash in some extent, or at least to feel you know him. To listen to George Strait is to listen to George Strait.
Yeah.
Like, it could turn out that guy lives in a penthouse in Manhattan, and it wouldn't change a thing about the music.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Absolutely, right? And that's what I'm saying. I think that he's just got... There is no there sort of thing, I think, for the scope of his career. Although the talent, and I do respect the kind of dedication to a very kind of stripped down original or originalist version of country music, I suppose. But
he's another one whose acting career was perhaps ill advised.
Wait, he has an acting career?
He made a movie. What was that? Was it Pure Country? Was that what it was called?
That's it. You nailed it. Yeah.
Boy, that was a terrible movie. Just be awful.
Surprised by this.
I just can't imagine George Strait would be a good actor.
Well, your imagination is correct.
So what's a good transition, though, to someone who actually does have, I think, a successful acting career is Rhea McIntyre. She plays a version of herself on that show, right? But she's in Tremors, which is one of an all-time great horror film.
That's right. She is. That's a great movie.
I didn't know she was in Tremors.
Yeah, she plays the wife of the survivalist. Yeah. And so she's someone who did transition into other forms of media very successfully, and she's somebody who definitely, I think, for a brief time fits this, particularly early on in the 80s. I think once like people like Randy Travis and George Strait establish a market for this kind of older sounding stuff, I think there was a place for her, because she had been recording since the mid 70s, but it was just sort of lost in the mush of Contrapolitan, right? And then once she gets to highlight her accent, which is very hillbilly, right, then I think she becomes noticeable. And then she becomes a megastar, and everything comes real high production, and I don't think you call it neo-traditional anymore, very quickly into the 80s. But a extremely important artist, in that she opened so many doors for other female country singers, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure you get the 1990s in country music without Reba McEntire and George Strait. I would say those are the two most important. I know you disagree with that, but those are the two most important just for the development of the music.
No, I'm not saying important in terms... I mean, he's definitely influential, right? But I just don't... I think his music's near as interesting as other stuff. I mean, in terms of, like, chart success, who's been more successful than George Strait, right?
Well, if you watch that Ken Burns documentary, I was struck by Garth Brooks, who we're talking about next time. Garth Brooks said he basically just wanted to be George Strait. And it makes total sense, right? Because Garth Brooks is in some way doing the George Strait thing, only Garth Brooks has a big personality, and the music kind of wraps itself around that personality.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I don't want to take up too much time, but got to talk about Randy Travis. I think he's, like, in terms of this sphere of country music, the most significant person, because he was an immense star while doing very traditional country songs, right?
Yeah.
With a voice that sounded, I mean, it was an incredible voice that sounded like nothing anybody else was doing at that time, and he just took over the world for most of the 80s, right? With really great songs too. I mean, he's not a hack. I mean, this guy performed the heck out of really great songs, and so yeah, Randy Travis is super important.
And he also kind of has an acting career.
Yeah.
He's the villain in an episode of King of the Hill.
That's a great episode.
Version of himself who steals a song from Peggy, and God bless him, because he comes off looking terrible in that episode. God bless him for having a sense of humor about it.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a great episode.
And he's—I think you can't. He's not like, he just looks like a shy kid who has this incredible gift, right? He doesn't have like a performer's personality per se, but man, I mean, just in terms of like pure gifts, I don't know that anybody's more talented than Randy Travis. I mean, he's not going to do a lot of range with the voice that he has, but man, he plumbed the depths of what his range allowed for sure. And he, until Garth Brooks comes around, I mean, he is like the most, I mean, in terms of record sales and charts and awards in the country music world, I mean, he is the biggest name in country music.
And well-deserved. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
Randy Travis is phenomenal. Another of those early concerts that I got to do when I was really young was Randy Travis, and it was great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
we should probably mention that he had some sort of medical emergency that had completely ended his ability to sing, I believe.
He had a stroke.
Yeah.
It was really sad, right? And I saw him on the Marty Stewart show. He was a singer. I didn't see him in person. I used to watch that show every week. He was doing his old songs. And man, there were times you could just see in his face the struggle to just get the notes out, right? And it was just, it was kind of inspiring and horrifying at the same time. Like, this guy is like working it hard, and it still sounded good, but man, he was really digging deep to get there. So a few other people I think that we should just lump in. I know that Michael's going to talk about Steve Earle probably, but I think Steve Earle, I think one of the things about that, when they create a market, when people like George Strait and Randy Travis and Dwight Yoakam achieve chart success with this throwbacky kind of sound that sounds distinct. I don't even say it's throwbacky, but it sounds distinctly country, right? In terms of instrumentation and mostly subject matter and that kind of thing. I think you get people from the 70s who were like respected in the Nashville scene, but never had like successful careers in terms of recording. And I think Steve Earle's in that group. I mean, he had been like writing songs with Townes Van Zandt and all that kind of stuff, right? And so he's someone who finally there's a place for him in the kind of mid 80s there. And I think Rodney Crowell is another person. He has a huge album in like 86 called what's that one? The one with all the hits on it. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. And so he finally gets a lot of chart success, but he'd been incredibly prolific as a songwriter, a player, and he had a number of really terrific albums before that as well. So, but he really becomes known in the wake of this too. And a couple guys, let me just talk about a couple ladies. Kathy Mattea, I think, is someone who I think probably comes in the wake of Reba McEntire, although she's completely different than Reba McEntire. She's from West Virginia, and she has this very rich baritone voice, almost like Anne Murray-ish baritone voice, but very rooted in sort of small town Southern life, right? And incidentally, she's also still a tremendously active artist who's making some of her best work now. She did a album of covers about songs about coal and coal mining called Coal that is just a fantastic album. So Kathy Mattea is someone also I think that is important to consider. I always loved Patti Loveless back in sort of the mid to late 80s. I thought she was terrific. And I think she was also very kind of traditional in that way. And I don't think we can get by without talking about Ricky Skaggs, who's brought the bluegrass kind of era or kind of angle into this. Yeah.
Newgrass, Danny. Newgrass.
Yes, exactly.
With Bill Monroe's blessing.
Yeah. Yep. And with great success. I mean, Ricky Skaggs was an incredible chart topper, like in the 80s, right? With extremely bluegrass sounding music. And now he's kind of become like an elder statesman of bluegrass. He's kind of drifted back into that world, right?
Yeah.
And a guy named Vern Gosden, did you guys ever hear of him?
I like Vern Gosden.
I do too.
I've never heard of him.
Yeah, but
Set Him Up, Joe.
Yeah.
They got a vintage Victrola 1951, full of my favorite records that I grew up on. They got old Hank and Lefty, and there's B-24. Set 'em up, Joe, and play Walking the Floor. Set 'em up, Joe, and play Walking the Floor. I'm gonna spend the night like every night before, playing E.T. and I'll play him some more. I gotta have a shot of them old troubadours. Yeah, set 'em up, Joe, and play Walking the Floor. Set 'em up, Joe, and play Walking the Floor.
Other artists would always talk about him as, quote, the voice of country music. They thought he had the best pure country voice. And he was an older guy at this point, so I think he was another one of these guys that kind of hung around. And, of course, there's many others that I'm sure I've forgotten, but I just want to kind of give a flavor of what that movement looked like. It's not, like I said, it's not a monolith, and I think it's a reaction to the kind of homogenization of pop country pop music. It's trying to make something more distinct.
Can we talk about John Anderson, Danny?
I love John Anderson.
Me too. He was my first favorite singer.
I forgot about him.
And I think he kind of bridges the gap between neo-traditionalist and urban cowboy, because his first song, his first big song, was this song called Swingin'.
Fantastic.
Chocolate pie. Mama was in the kitchen cutting chicken up to fry. Daddy was in the backyard rolling up a garden hose. I was on the porch with Charlotte feeling up down to my toes, and we were swinging.
Swinging.
Yes, we were swinging.
Swinging.
Little Charlotte, she's a pretty as the angels when they sang. I can't believe I'm
swinging. It is a fantastic song. Yes,
it's something.
By the late 80s, early 90s, he's making, I think, very straightforward neo-traditionalist records with some really stellar songs, and he's got a great voice that kind of hangs, if that makes sense. His voice doesn't do what a voice is supposed to do. He's always a little behind the beat.
Yeah.
But he's a great singer, and he has a song that's one of the very few country conservationist songs called Seminole Wind.
Yeah.
Which is all about the way that the modern society is destroying the Everglades. He's from Florida. I loved John Anderson when I was a kid, and I still love him now.
Yeah, John, I do too. One of my favorite like YouTube rabbit trails is John Anderson videos from the early 80s. He's fantastic. Wild and Blue, I mean, is an amazing song. And he has such a unique voice.
If you know he ain't home,
Why do you keep calling? You're gonna drive yourself crazy, and you know that it's true. It's just making you wild and blue. Wild and blue. It's no wonder. Look at the things that you do. They could just take you up a yonder, honey. You're already wild.
Like, I mean, I would say he may have one of the top five voices in country music. He's so distinctive, and when he's on, it's incredible. John Anderson's great.
And fun, too, right? I mean, Black Sheep is just a great, great song.
It is.
My daddy was a brakeman on a highball traveling train. Mama, she raised four little children, and her family had a good name. And Papa and Mama wanted all for us they never had. Big brother, little brother, and sister too, none of them turned out half bad. Except me, I'm the black sheep of the family. Big brother went to college and became a doctor, man. I guess he makes about $1 million a year off the folks on insurance plan. He's got a big, long Mercedes Benz and a house overlooking the town. He sits in his jacuzzi and he watches the sun go down. And he feels real sorry for me. I'm the black sheep of the family. Yeah, I drive me a big old semi-truck. I'm making payments on a two-room shack. My wife, she waits on tables, and at night she rubs my back. And I tell her what my papa said to my mama when he got off a highball train. Oh, wake me up early, be good to my dogs, and teach my children to pray.
And that's a great written song. I have to say, The little details of his family's life are so specific. I mean, it's great writing, right? And John Anderson's the best.
Not to be confused with John Anderson, the lead singer of Yes.
No. Not to be confused there. As you said, Michael, he's sort of a... all of these have... a foot in each of these camps. But that does kind of shift the focus a little bit, and he's a good transition point into what do you prefer, young country or new country?
Oh, I don't know. I don't really like either of those terms, and I've been trying to figure out what these people have in common, other than that they don't really fit into the country mainstream in the 80s.
Yeah, so the term comes from Hank Williams Jr., who I forgot to put on the list. Mm. The idea being that this is sort of a, like I said at the beginning, kind of the genuine next generation, right? They don't necessarily have direct connections, other than, of course, Hank Williams Jr. is the son of Hank Williams. But they didn't necessarily get their start playing backup for anyone else. They haven't been in the industry for decades. They are kind of genuinely new on the scene. Now, that doesn't apply to all of them, but I think that's the idea behind it. Which there is something intentionally different going on. So if the neo-traditionalists are trying to preserve the tone of the previous generation, the young country is trying to be country while doing something new.
Yeah, something really entirely different. And what they're doing is not the same for any of them. I mean, you talk about neo-traditionalist country being rangy. Young country is so rangy that I'm not sure they really have much in common, other than that 10 years later they would all get pushed into the Americana basket.
Yeah. Right. Or just completely ignored. I mean, when was the last time you heard Katie Lang on the radio?
Yeah, but my God, I love Katie Lang. Mm-hmm. What a voice. She is one of the best female singers of any genre who has ever lived, and she does this really corny style of music, right? She's doing torch ballads and adult contemporary music and mixing it with new wave and country. And that should be terrible. But she sings it with such conviction, and she's such a good singer that, man, I would listen to her sing anything.
Yeah. And she's important, too, because I mean, in terms of her sexuality, right?
Right.
Sure. In country music, that's like trailblazing for her to be kind of obviously gay, right?
Yeah, very androgynous.
Yeah, and that's like, I mean, just there's no precedent for that, really, that I can think of.
Yeah, but by the time I didn't actually hear K.D. Lang, and even now I haven't heard a whole lot of K.D. Lang, but until probably grad school, just because of her sexuality, she'd been ostracized from country radio. And of course, in the pre-internet days, that was the only way you could really, short of buying albums, that was the only way you could listen to it. So I hadn't heard her until easily within the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, I mean, she was kept out of country radio in part because of her sexuality. I don't want to downplay that, but also because the kind of music she was doing was really uncool.
What
I mean?
Sure.
But somehow she made it cool. I hesitate to lay too much on her sexuality, not because it's not groundbreaking, but because I'm afraid that makes people think, oh, she's one of those people who's important but not good. She's so good.
No, absolutely.
So if I were, that's fair. If I were 10 years older, I would have heard her on the radio, because she was established, and even in country, top 40 stations and such, in the kind of mid 80s, and then fell off both because of the direction her music went and then because of her sexuality.
Yeah. She put out an album a few years ago with Nico Case and Laura Veers. Have either of you heard that record?
No. Oh, so, yes, I have. I have heard that, yeah.
It's great, and she out-sings both of them. Laura Veers is a so-so singer, but Nico Case is a great singer, and K.D. Lang just puts her to shame. I mean, it's amazing what she can still do with that voice, even three decades later. So.
And the artistic vision, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't just like an instrument. I mean, she was like a very ambitious artist in terms of what she wanted to create, and so, yeah.
And there was nobody else doing it, so she's standing alone in a lot of ways. Steve Earle, we've talked about a little bit. I think of Steve Earle as being a kind of combination of the Sex Pistols and Townes Van Zandt, and it's hard to imagine anything that would fit in less well on country radio in the late 80s than Steve Earle. Although, Danny, if you say he had a presence on the radio, I'll believe you.
When?
In the late 80s.
By then he's doing like Copperhead Road, which I don't think gets played. I think you'd probably be more likely to hear that on college radio than country radio.
Yeah, it's where I think he probably belongs.
Yeah, it's more like stadium rock country almost. Yeah.
And then he becomes one of the major figures in Americana music, really kind of a god figure in Americana music. I think you kind of can't understand that genre without understanding or at least listening to Steve Earle. I'll admit I don't like him that much. I don't like his voice, but I recognize that what he's doing is interesting and important.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I love his first album with, Guitar Town and all that. Those kind of like road anthems, I guess. And I love Copperhead Road, but beyond that, there's like, it's hit and miss for me. I actually like his son a lot more than him.
Justin Townes Earle, right?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Yeah, I've seen Justin Townes Earle a couple times in concert. I love his albums. I think he's great. Yeah.
And I think when you talk about Steve Earle, you're really talking about the moment this young country thing or neo-traditionalist country or whatever gets mixed with what gets called alternative country.
Yeah.
Which are we doing an episode on that?
We can, if you guys want to.
Uncle Tupelo, right?
Right, yeah. And I think Steve Earle kind of stands shoulder to shoulder with Uncle Tupelo more than he does with George Strait.
Yeah.
But if we're going to do an alternative country episode, I'll save my opinions on that genre for then.
I know so little about that, but that doing an episode is a good excuse to learn, so sure.
The other guy I really want to talk about is Lyle Lovett, who I love and who is as weird as mainstream singers can possibly be. He looks weird. He acts weird. His music is weird. He's funny and mean and really surprisingly sensitive sometimes. His first big hit is a song called God Will. Do you guys know that song?
I love that song.
keeps on trusting you when you've been cheating and spending your nights on town? Who keeps on saying that he still wants you when you're through running around? And who keeps on loving you when you've been lying, saying things ain't what they seem? Well, God does, but I don't. God will, but I won't. And that's the difference between God and me. Well, God does, but I don't. God will, but I won't. And that's the difference between God and me.
Which, I mean, it's a really nasty song, which it essentially is. Says, I won't forgive you, but God will.
Yeah, it's you're right. Go ahead.
So, I mean, in the late 80s, when all this stuff is bubbling up, he puts out a record called Lyle Lovett and His Large Band.
Yeah.
Which is essentially half a country, a kind of Americana country record, and half a big band record with not quite novelty big band songs, but funny big band songs that border on novelty, right? So the first song after, there's like a horn intro, but the first song on Lyle Lovett and His Large Band is a song called Here I Am,
yeah,
which features these kind of absurdist spoken verses and then a really simple chorus, and it is glorious.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm the guy who sits next to you and reads the newspaper over your shoulder. Wait. Don't turn the page. I'm not finished. Life is so uncertain.
Here I am. Yes, it's me. Take my hand and you'll see. Here I am. Yes, it's true.
Given that true intellectual and emotional compatibility are at the very least difficult, if not impossible, to come by, we could always opt for the more temporal gratification of sheer physical attraction. That wouldn't make you a shallow person, would it?
Here I am. Yes, it's me. Take my hand.
There is no precedent for Lyle Lovett. I mean, I can't not think. I mean, in country music especially. I mean, he has more in common with someone like David Byrne, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. But also, he clearly has a great respect for the history of country music, and a lot of what he does is more or less traditional country music. So, I mean, he really has a wide range. Even just on his first few records, he does, and you know, he's still making music and still making good music, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
The song everybody knows by Lyle Lovett is a song called Church, which really is a novelty song. And it's about going to church and the preacher preaches too long and everybody wants to go home and eat lunch. And it's funny, but it's 5 minutes long and there's only one joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that song is a little overrated, but man, he's good. And he's not a great singer the way Katie Lang is a great singer, but he knows how to use his voice for the things he wants to use it for, if that makes sense.
What do you think of his cover of Stand By Your Man? I think he's trying to do something really interesting with that.
Sometimes it's hard to be a woman, given all you love to just one man. But you have been
things that you don't understand. But if you love him, you forgive him, even though he's hard to understand. And if you love him, oh, be proud of him, 'cause after all, he's just a man. Stand by your man, give him two arms to cling to, and something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely. Stand by your man and show the world you love him. Keep giving all
Well, you know, he did it for The Crying Game.
Okay. I did not know that. Okay.
And maybe now everybody doesn't know all there is to know about The Crying Game, but The Crying Game was a movie. Was a movie in the early 90s, which was about a woman who turns out to have been... Oh, what's the right way to say this, Danny? I don't want to say anything that'll offend anybody.
I mean, transgender, we would right. say now, but back then, a transvestite, they would say, right?
Right.
But, yeah.
Right. So the cover of Stand By Your Man is a kind of gender swapped version of this song, and obviously he's got a kind of postmodern wink to it. What do you think he's doing with it?
Well, I mean, because his persona, I mean, he is very mean in his music, right? I but in a charming way. I don't know how to say it. He's like the Hugh Grant of like sexual relations, I suppose. He's like a charming bastard, right? I'm sorry. You might have to, but the,
I don't know. Do we have to bleep that one? I don't know what the rules are.
But that is a persona, right? Because by all accounts, Lyle Lovett is one of the sweetest guys who's ever lived.
For sure. Right. And so I feel like he's, by singing the song is in a completely straightforward way. It's not an unironic cover. I mean, down to the vocalizations. I think he's trying to kind of like demonstrate the kind of creepy sexism of that great song, right? And when you hear it out of a man's mouth, it just sounds like abusive, right? And so I think he's trying to do something really interesting, and I think it works. It's a really great cover of it. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
I have a hard time taking it straight. The song right after it on that record, I believe, is called She's Leaving Me Because She Really Wants To.
Yeah.
Which is, it sounds like a parody country title, doesn't it?
Yes.
Like, you're the reason our kids are ugly. My favorite Lyle Lovett song is one called Family Reserve, which is off that same record. It's, I think, his third record. It's called Joshua Judge's Roof.
When I saw the ambulance screaming down Main Street, I didn't give it a thought. But it was my Uncle Eugene. He died on October the 2nd, 1981. And my Uncle Wilbur, they all called him Skinner. And they said for his younger ways, he'd get drunk in the morning and show me the rolls of 50s and 100s he kept in the glove box of his old gray Impala. And we're all gonna be here forever. So mama, don't you make such a stir and put on that camera. Come on and join up the last of the family reserve.
I love that song. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's an interesting song, too. It's all about the members of his family who have died in unpleasant or unusual or amusing ways.
The one about the little boy choking on a peanut butter and jelly sandwich while someone just helplessly watches. It's like, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, but he sings it very flatly.
Yeah.
So if you can hear the song 100 times, and if you're not listening really closely to what he's saying, you don't understand how bleak the song is.
Yeah.
What's the? He has the friend who jumps off of the motel balcony, and it says he missed the swimming pool only by inches.
Yeah. Yeah, and everyone said he was drunk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my favorite Lyle Lovett song. I think that does everything he does well. It's got the kind of meanness, it's got the irony, but it's also got a real sensitivity to it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
I guess we have to mention that he was married to Julia Roberts for 18 months.
And dumped her.
Did he dump her? I didn't know that.
That was the way I understood it, is that he dumped her. Maybe I'm misremembering something, but yeah.
She was considered the most beautiful woman in the world at the time, and if you don't know what Lyle Lovett looks like, you should definitely Google him.
He's a Dwight Yoakam character, that's for sure.
He's uglier than Dwight Yoakam.
And he's got bizarre hair. I mean, Yeah.
There's that 90s Mary Chapin Carpenter song about how she goes into a bar, and Dwight Yoakam and Lyle Lovett are both there trying to, you know, competing for her attention.
Now 11 million later, I was sitting at the bar. I bought the house a double and the waitress a new car. Dwight Yoakam's in the corner trying to catch my eye. Lyle Lovett's right beside me with his hand up on my thigh. Oh, I love the story. It's simple, but it's true. Hey, the stars might lie, but the numbers never do. I feel lucky.
Yeah.
I don't know that song.
That's a great song, yeah.
And she's another person who kind of belongs in this category, and what she's doing is mixing 60s folk with country music. And she's a wonderful songwriter. She put out a record just a few years ago. Sometimes Just the Sky is the album and the song. And I won't spoil that song, but everyone should go listen to it. It's beautiful, and it'll make you cry. But her big song in the 80s was This Shirt, which is all about a shirt and all the things it's been through, and by extension, all the things she's been through while wearing it. And it does what she does well, which is it's a very simple song, but very the emotions in it are very deep. You guys got anything to say about Mary Chapin Carpenter?
She's like right at the cusp of the division that we're talking about, right? If she's in the 80s, it's the very end, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And her big hit is Shut Up and Kiss Me, which is in the 90s.
Yeah.
Well, and I Feel Lucky, which is the song that has Lyle Lovett and Dwight Yoakam in it.
I'll have to find that one. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, anything else out of this this young country new country or whatever we want to call it?
What do you say about Tanya Tucker there, Michael? Because she's really in. She's almost like two characters, because there's the young Tanya Tucker from the 70s, but then, she does have an entirely different career in the 80s, so I don't know how to place her. But.
Yeah, well, she starts off as this kind of teenage vocal prodigy. She does Delta Dawn, and the whole bit with Tanya Tucker is she's 13 years old, and she sings like she's 45 and has been through life, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's a kind of novelty factor to some of those Tanya Tucker singles in the 70s. I think they kind of gave her some songs that would purposely draw out that contradiction. Mm-hmm. And like every child raised in the entertainment industry, things go poorly for Tanya Tucker.
Yeah.
I think she marry Glenn Campbell, or does he?
There's a relationship there that I can't believe someone didn't go to jail for. Yeah.
Right. I mean, he was 15 years old. She was 15 or 16, and he was in his late 30s.
Yeah.
Right. She really gets kind of abused by the industry and then forgotten, and she has this big comeback in the late 80s, and as I understand it, her songs then are much more in the urban cowboy pop country model and less interesting in a lot of ways.
Yeah, she's probably more sales, right? But artistically,
she was a huge artist in the late 80s.
Yeah, and she did have this, like, I don't know, because she was like owning her own story finally, right? There was this kind of I don't know, inspirational aspect to her career, the comeback nature of it, right? So I do think she's like really important.
And it's worth pointing out she's back again. She put out another record this year, I think, and it's in that kind of Americana vein. I haven't heard it.
Yeah, she's on tour right now. She'll actually be, by the time this drops, who knows, but she'll be coming through my part of Missouri, next month, the month after, something like that.
Yeah. You going to go see her?
I don't think so, but when a country performer who's a big name comes through, I so far have been emailing whatever their management company is and saying, hey, I'd love to interview so-and-so for this podcast, and as of yet have not received a reply from any of them. But I'm going to keep at it.
We've all had bad luck getting musicians to interview on Christian Humanist Profiles. The only musician I've ever gotten is Steve Taylor, and that's because we complained on the main show that he wouldn't do an interview with us, and finally he emailed us. But we've emailed people that you would think we would be able to get, and we couldn't get them. So
I told you how disappointed I was with that, right?
With the Steve Taylor interview?
Yeah, well, I saw you announced it, and then the episode dropped, so I was like, this is going to be great. I love Steve Tyler. Like, I don't know how you got him.
You thought it was from Aerosmith.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's himself a country singer now, I believe.
Oh,
music is now what you do when you flunk out of rock music.
Yeah, it's true. Bon Jovi did it like 10 years ago, and yeah, it's true.
Anything else you want to say on the? I guess I left Hank Williams Jr. off because he's kind of his own thing.
I find him very uninteresting. Like I honestly, I think his kid is way better than him. Like Hank III is at least interesting. Like as a weird punk singer, punk version of his grandfather. I think Hank Williams is super interesting. Hank III is super interesting, and Hank Williams Jr. is like a product of like the worst parts of Nashville. Like I find a couple of his songs memorable, but not many, honestly. They're all like very self-aggrandizing, and I he's kind of an odious person, just generally, I think, and in terms of his public persona and his politics.
Well, Danny, what's the difference between his postmodern myth making and Dwight Yoakam's?
Well, gosh, that's a really good question. I think Dwight Yoakam is developing a persona of the kind of country bumpkin in the city looks like in the 80s, right? And I think Hank Williams Jr. is trying to puff himself up as one of the greats, right? And I think he's just trying, he's like, he wants to be Waylon Jennings, but is never going to be Waylon Jennings. And so,
okay, well, let me ask you a different question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between him doing that and David Allan Coe doing that? Because David Allan Coe has about 400 songs about how he's just like Waylon Jennings and Merle Haggard.
David Allan Coe is like subversive and therefore interesting, I think, in some ways. I think Hank Williams Jr. is just sort of, I don't know. I feel like he's like the privileged rich kid who wants to act like they made it from the streets, kind of. I don't know. I find him just very inauthentic. And David Allan Coe definitely self-aggrandizes, right? But it's only to the point of parody of that, I think. I don't even know that. And they're better songs, too, frankly. I mean,
I'm not defending Hank Jr., make no mistake.
Yeah, that's just not good.
You don't like If Heaven Ain't a Lot Like Dixie, I Don't Want to Go?
If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I don't want to go. If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I just as soon stay home. I was one of the chosen few to be born in Alabama. I'm just like my daddy's son. I'm proud of who I am. I went through a lot of good women and shook old Jim Beam's hand. If I never see pearly gates, I've walked through the promised land. If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I don't want to go. If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I'd just as soon stay home. If they don't have a grand old Opry like they do in Tennessee, just send me to hell or New York City, it would be about the same.
No. All my Rowdy
if the friends, South would have won, we'd have had it made.
yeah, that's hideous, right? All My Rowdy Friends Have Settled Down is a pretty interesting song. But, yeah, I can't imagine anybody else singing that song because it's all about Hank Williams Jr., right? And so, I don't know. I'm going to
push back on you again, Danny, because weren't you complaining about George Strait that he didn't have a personality?
Well, it has to be an attractive personality.
You know, when I woke up this morning, I didn't imagine that I'd be playing devil's advocate with you about Hank Williams Jr., whom I've always hated.
Hitler has a personality. Does it mean I want one? I just,
say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, dude. At least it's an ethos.
Exactly.
I guess I'll be the Hank Williams Jr. actual defender. I think his songs are kind of fun, although... it seems to be pretty straightforward country pop, like country-politan music. Certainly not as good as he thinks it is, but maybe that's just because I grew up, you know, watching Monday Night Football and have been indoctrinated into thinking he's a good performer by seeing it every week for, you know, all of my life growing up.
It's a good point. He's ubiquitous, right? Can I say I really regret not mentioning Marty Stewart as an artist.
I can't believe you didn't.
I had it down and I skipped over it. I just got to say, Hillbilly Rock came out in like the late 80s, 87, 88, something like that. And it was very rockabilly throwback, really great, fun album and great song.
It comes from Mississippi and down in Alabama. Like a fever all across the land, from deep in the Delta on the Louisiana shore, the people got to have it, they wanna hear some more. It's a hillbilly rock, beat it with a drum, playing the guitars like shooting from a gun, keeping up the rhythm, steady as a clock, doing a little thing called the hillbilly rock. Some say it came from Memphis, down in Tennessee. Boy, it drifted in from Georgia about 1953. Just as long as it's greasy, as long as it's fast, as long as it's pumping, honey, it's gonna last. It's a hillbilly rock, beat it with a drum, playing them guitars like shooting from a gun, keeping up the rhythm, steady as a clock, doing a little thing called a hillbilly rock.
Marty Stewart has been around, one of those guys, he's been around forever. I mean, he traveled with Johnny Cash when he was like 12 years old or something. Like, he grew up in country music, and he has become like this kind of elder statesman for the traditions of country music. And honestly, in the last 20 years, 15 years, he is like, I think, become, he's almost like the Martin Scorsese of country music. He's like, he's not only a practitioner,
but with talent.
Well, now, come on now.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, you guys have been doing all these episodes on Martin Scorsese, and at some point we'll do A City of Man about how terrible his movies are. But that's for another time.
That's a dumb opinion. That's a
dumb opinion. It is. But Marty Stewart is that kind of practitioner slash like historian, right? And he's like a really important figure in country music.
Did you watch the Ken Burns documentary?
I did not, but I know he was in it.
You've got to. He's the star of it. He is on every episode and tells the best stories, including the story of how he met his wife. Which is amazing, and I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah. I got to go to a couple tapings for his show, and it was just fantastic. It was like 20 seats in this little thing. I'm there standing right with him and that amazing band, and I can't say enough about Marty Stewart. He's great, and it doesn't surprise me. He's like when Ken Burns made the jazz thing, he basically just relied on Wynton Marsalis, right? And he's very much the Wynton Marsalis of country music. I think it's a really good comparison. Yeah.
For the listeners, the Ken Burns country music history, country music is excellent. I haven't finished it yet, so maybe it goes south, you know, at the end of the documentary. But the first few episodes are excellent. But remember, we were there first.
I did wonder if we were going to continue doing this show after Ken Burns came in the middle of it and did better than we could.
I really just wanted to get that first episode dropped before he released the series. But and we made it, and we're not going to, you know, obviously finish it before he does. But we were there first.
You know what, though? You got to release these faster. People are telling me about things that I've said that I have no memory.
No memory.
Somebody's tagging me in a tweet about something I said about Christy Lane, and I have no memory of this.
It's like, I don't even know who that is.
The song, the Jesus, Lord Help Me Jesus, what is it called? One Day at a Time. I apparently trashed that song, which I hate, so I totally believe that I trashed her on the air, but I have no memory of doing it because it's been so long.
we will do what we can. That is...
I'm just joking.
Yeah, that is not entirely in my control.
As long as it's in that terrible Martin Scorsese episode, it's fine.
So. Yeah. Well, yeah, by the time people hear this, they'll be like, they did episodes on Martin Scorsese. Well, anything else out of any of these? Otherwise, we should wrap things up. Again, as with many of these episodes, there's little political in the 80s in country music, and maybe even less than in previous generations. Of course, we're out of the Vietnam War, so there's just not the same need for protest music as there had been earlier, although... when we get around to alternative country, maybe we'll see some exceptions to that.
You have Lee Greenwood's horrific song.
I feel like that song doesn't come into its own until the 90s, though. Even though he records it in the late 80s.
Yeah, I remember high school, so it was in the 80s. Yeah.
And obviously things will be radically different once we hit the 90s, because that's when all of a sudden politics is everywhere, and especially into the 2000s. But things change, and things change radically, and that's what we'll get into in the next episode. Again, this feels like a transitional era to me until something revolutionary and new was born, which we'll talk about in the next episode when we focus on the person who single-handedly changed the landscape and of country music for better or worse. So our next episode, we will focus on Garth Brooks. And with that, the City Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in the family. Get more info about our own show and our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes. Help other people find the show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100 years. The voices sound sad as they're singing along. Another piece of America's lost.